Thank you very much, Gina. It's good to hear your voice again. When Linda and I were in Cincinnati, we had the opportunity to hear Gina sing several times there. It's good to hear your voice again. Beautiful. Thank you. And congratulations to you and Jim for your son, Jim. And to your grandparents, whom we've already congratulated several times, Jim. So we have several new Jims coming along here. Nice to have you visit our area. Today I will be discussing an important topic to all of us today, building godly relationships. Managing relationships is probably the most difficult challenge all of us face, isn't it? I don't know if you thought about it this way, but God is all about relationships. God's relationship to the spirit world is chronicled in the Bible. Our relationship with Jesus Christ, our relationship with one another, God's relationship with Christ, God's relationship to man, our relationship to God. When you think about it, the Bible has considerable to say about relationships, and God is all about relationships. I think one of the most challenging areas that I've found in my life is relationships with my family. I don't know about you, but sometimes those who are closest to us present the hardest and the most difficult relationship challenges, don't they? I'm going to tell you about my relationship with my son. My son is, he just turned 40, so this is some years ago, back in 1992. My son is he'd be fourth generation Christian, but my father went to Ambassador College, graduated and worked and served for the church for over 25 years as an employee, and then another 25 years or so as an elder, serving on several church boards and dedicated his life to the church. I went to Ambassador College, and I assumed that my son would be the third generation to go to Ambassador College. And I kind of pushed him in that direction. And I kept telling him, you're going to be the third generation to go. Your grandfather went, and I went, and, you know, bully for you to go to Ambassador. And so he reluctantly went to Ambassador. And he called me up near the end of his first year and said, Dad, they have more rules here than you had on me in the seventh grade. I don't think this place is for me. And of course, I tried to encourage him, well, hang in there and, you know, it'll work out. And you're just kind of feeling, I didn't want to say homesick, but I thought maybe, you know, he's away from home and maybe he's wishing for the way things used to be. Anyway, we had a few discussions, but in the end, he decided after a year to return home and drop out of college. Well, his mother and I were disappointed. And I could tell he was disappointed that he disappointed us. And that kind of hurt him. And the next thing we knew, he started getting involved with some of his old high school buddies in town. And he bounced from one temporary job to another. And the next thing we knew, our son was staying out, you know, all night long. At that time, he was 19 years of age. And, 19-year-olds know a great deal about the world and what's going on in the world. At least they think they do. And then it got to be two nights or three nights that he was missing, and we couldn't depend on him to show up at a regular hour. And he had a younger brother who was just starting his junior year of high school, and I was concerned about the impression it was going to make on his younger brother. And then we found some drug paraphernalia in my son's belongings. And I confronted him. And we found out that he was experimenting with different drugs. And it was very concerning to us, as you might imagine. And it began a struggle You know, what do we do? How do we handle the situation in our family? The embarrassment you can imagine that's experienced by a pastor whose son is kind of in and out of church, one foot in, one foot out. He's obviously experimenting with drugs. And I told him point blank, I said, look, you can't live a double lifestyle. You can't be a hypocrite. What's it going to be, one life or the other? He dropped out of church. And we found that we put some house rules on him when he had to be in. Because he was living with us, and when he should be out working, and he kept violating those rules, he would sneak into the house. It was just creating a terrible situation for the family and a bad example for his little brother. So in the end, his mother and I decided that we were going to have to ask him to leave the house, which is a very difficult thing for a parent to do, to have to kick their kid out of their house. Especially at age 19 or 20, because he was getting close to 20 years of age when this happened. And, he finally left. He was angry. We were upset. And we didn't hear from him for about 4 months. And, of course, for a parent who knows their child is maybe experimenting with drugs, gone for 4 months, you never hear anything from them, you wonder what's happened to them. You know, are they in a gutter somewhere? Are they dead? Were they living? We checked with a few of his friends who were all kind of very evasive about what had happened to him. We didn't know where he was. We prayed very hard that God would, protect him. We prayed very hard. We read the example of the prodigal son, that he would come to himself and he would return home. We wanted him to be in our house and a part of our household. And after 4 months, he did call. And he said, Dad, can I come home? And I said, of course you can come home. We've always taught our kids, there's always a soft place to land at home. But our relationship was obviously very strained at that point. And he did come home, and he had come to a lot of decisions that were good decisions. And I'm very pleased to tell you that he did recover from the drug experimentation he was involved in. And he's a responsible adult today, responsible for his personality and temperament type. And I want to explain that a little bit, because it was at this time that I began to search, for some reason I'm not reaching my son. How do I get through to him? And I was treating my son the way I would want to be treated. I was direct with him. I was forthright. I would try to steer him in the right direction. I tried to encourage him, but I was pretty tough on him. And he didn't respond well to that. And it presented a real challenge for our entire family for, as you might imagine, the better part of a year. As I said, in the end, he has come through that kind of maturing process. We're very thankful for that, and I think that's God's blessing that has happened. And Linda and I have a very good relationship with our 40-year-old son. And he just returned from a trip to Bali, and he can't wait to come up here and show us the pictures and how good of a time he had. He likes to travel internationally. He's fairly successful in the professions that he has chosen. But my son is more melancholy. He's a little more creative than I am. And it was like we were two ships passing in the night. It just didn't work. I didn't have the tools to deal with him or to communicate or to get through to him. And it was during that time period that I stumbled across this book by Taylor Hartman called The Color Code. And that's what we're going to be addressing today in part. During my sermon, though, I want to talk about something at a higher level from the Bible, which I think you'll clearly see in a moment. But I discovered some very important things about myself and about my son and my family at that time. And it was very helpful to me to make these discoveries. So I want to share some of that with you today. And I want to share during the sermon what I found out from a biblical perspective, as I said, a little higher level than just reading a book about temperaments and personalities. But it really opened a door for me. My son and I actually sat down and we did this profile together, and we talked about our differences. And it was eye-opening for me and for him. And since then, we began to rebuild our relationship. And as I said, we have a good relationship today. So I plan to share with you today some of my discoveries, and I'm confident that some of the things that I discovered will be helpful to you as well. And that's why I like to share this particular message. We're going to see if this works from a distance. Would help if I turned it on. You want to advance the slide there, Brent? Try it again. Aha, there it is. As I mentioned, God is all about relationships. And I'd like to begin in 1 John chapter 4 and verse 8, because God is love. God is love. I think we all know that. In John 4 and verse 8, it says, "He who does not love does not know God, for God is love." Love is the epitome, especially when you understand the words for love here, agape. I'm not going to go into that, but I think we all at least comprehend a certain level of that. It is about relationships, isn't it? God's relationship first with us. It says God first loved us. Even before we were born, He wanted us to be a part of His family in a general sense. So God is love, and that is all about relationships. Secondarily, we read that God and Jesus Christ have a great relationship. In John 10:30, I'm not going to turn there, but Christ said, "I and my Father are one." They connected. You know, they have a connection. They work very well together, as we all know, and we're very thankful for. Also, a basic principle, God and Jesus Christ desire a relationship with mankind. Let's read verse 10 here in 1 John 4. "In this is love, not that we love God, but that He loved us and sent His Son to be a propitiation for our sins." So God initiated the first step by offering His Son, and His Son offered Himself. That allows us then to have a relationship with God. As Paul said, whereby we can say, "Abba Father," Daddy Father. So God wants a close relationship with us. And that comes through Jesus Christ. The desire to have this relationship with mankind. And individually with those whom He calls. And, of course, in verse 11, "Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another." And this becomes the challenge. We are told to have loving relationships with one another because of the logic we see on the screen. God is love. God and Christ work together. God loved us. Therefore, He wants us to have loving relationships. And that's what I want to talk about today, is loving relationships. And as I mentioned, and I think all of us well know, some of the most challenging times we have are relationship challenges. When I served in the church in Canada, my first pastor was in Calgary, Alberta, and I pastored a little Bible study in a place called Drumheller, Alberta, which is way out in the prairies. Maybe some of you have heard of the town of Drumheller. It's famous for its prehistoric bones out of the tar pits that they've dug up out there, some dinosaur bones. And we had a little Bible study group out there, and I would drive out there probably about twice a month, and do a Bible study for that group. And I always drive back at night, and because it was in the evening, we'd have the Bible study. And I remember one night the snow was blowing across the prairie, and you know, you kind of get these gusts that blow across the roadway. And I was focusing on the highway, but I always liked to, on my way home, I always liked to listen to a radio commentator by the name of Earl Nightingale. Anybody remember him? Nope. Anybody remember Earl Nightingale? Paul Harvey? Anybody remember Paul Harvey? He's like the Paul Harvey of Canada. Okay? And Earl Nightingale had these pithy stories and sayings that he would present once in a while on his program. And he talked about relationships one night, and I was driving in the snow, focusing and listening with one ear to Earl Nightingale. And he made this statement, and it kept going through my mind. And I had to pull off the road and get a pen and paper out, and I wrote this down. And I'd like to share that quote that he gave us, that he was talking about personal relationships. He said, "Maintaining a successful relationship is like juggling three bottles of nitroglycerin while balancing on a hammock suspended between two galloping horses at night during a hurricane." Let me repeat that. "Maintaining a successful relationship is like juggling three bottles of nitroglycerin while balancing on a hammock suspended between two galloping horses at night during a hurricane." I thought, boy, that says it all. It was about the time I heard this statement. It was about the time I was going through some personal issues with some members of the church. And I thought, how can I get through to these folks? You know, how can they successfully get through to me? You know, we need to be communicating on the same level. And I remembered that statement, wrote it down, and put it in my notes, and I've used it a few times over the years because it just seems to summarize the challenge that we have in maintaining and developing and building godly relationships, doesn't it? It's hard. It's not easy. And I think not only we in the church know that, but everybody knows that it's challenging. And I think one of the saddest things is when I meet with somebody and I ask them about their family, and they say, "Well, I haven't talked to my father or my mother in 20 years, or I haven't seen my brother, you know, in 50 years. I think that's really sad. I remember going to a seminar one time, and the presenter, he said, "Those of you that are the most fortunate are the ones who still have childhood friends." And I thought about that for a minute, and I thought, you know, a lot of us, we move and we leave behind those childhood friends, but thankfully, a number of my childhood friends serve in the ministry with me, and I grew up with those men and women, and we still have a relationship, and I consider that a great blessing, a wonderful blessing. I'd like us to notice Paul's example and what his attitude was. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians 9. Reading from verses 19 through 22. 1 Corinthians 9, 19. Paul said, "For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a servant to all that I might win the more." Paul talked about this concept of it's important to try to reach people, to try to communicate with people. Now, obviously, and we're going to see this, especially during the Bible study, that sometimes there are people with whom we meld more. Personalities or temperaments kind of match, and you go, "Boy, I really hit it off with so-and-so." You know, there are some people we have close friendships with, normally with whom we hit it off very well. And if you notice, there are other people where you go, "Boy, we're not on the same page." And yet you'd like to be able to communicate with this person, but there seems to be a void somehow. What causes that? Well, Paul is setting a pretty high bar here. In verse 20, he says, "To the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might win the Jews. To those who were under the law, as under the law, that I might win those who were under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, not being without law toward God, of course, but under law toward Christ, that I might win those who are without law." And verse 22, "To the weak I became as weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some." And Paul felt it was very important in his personal life that we have relationships where we could connect with people from all different backgrounds and levels. And I've noticed this in God's church. That's often what happens, isn't it? You look in a congregation, you know, you see some people that are well-educated, some people that didn't get much of a formal education. You see some people that are very successful financially, and others are more like me, you know. You kind of get by paycheck to paycheck. You find some people that are on welfare, and you find some people that do very well. We come from several different, what the world would call social strata, and we're called in God's church. Whereas sometimes other congregations that are more like neighborhood congregations, you find there's a certain income level that goes there, a certain education level that goes to that congregation. They seem to draw, you know, more of a common group of people. But in God's church, my experience is that God calls people, you know, through this vast strata within our culture. And it's not just here, it's in other parts of the world, too. Linda and I have had the chance to visit congregations like in Singapore. And the congregation there, even though small, has that same stratification. You have families, you have older men, you have older women, you have younger men, you have a single guy, single girl, you know, they all want to get married, but not to each other. And, you know, they're always traveling for the feast to find that person. When I was studying church history, one remarkable fact that I found was that first church in Newport, Rhode Island, that first Sabbath-keeping church that was finally pushed out of the Baptist group, the demographic of that church, there were seven people, was exactly across the same demographic lines we have in God's church today. There was a bachelor, there was a single woman, there was a family, there were widows, and a widower. Covered the whole spectrum. And that little church of seven people. And I thought, that's kind of a model, you know, that God's church has followed that pattern down through the ages. Kind of remarkable. Which, of course, presents challenges for all of us, doesn't it? It does present challenges for us, just like it did when Paul was working and serving in the church. Let's notice, I've got to remember to advance my slides. 1 Corinthians 10 now, verse 32. Paul says, "Give no offense either to the Jews or to the Greeks or to the church of God." You know, some people say, "Well, you just got to tell them like it is. You got to hit them between the eyes with a 2x4." I tried that with my son. It didn't work very well for me. And I'll talk about why in just a minute. "Just as I also please all men in all things," verse 33, "not seeking my own profit, but the profit of many, that they may be saved." And as I said during the feast, we look at all members of the human race and we say, there go a future son of God, one of God's children. Wherever they are, in God's church or not in the church. And chapter 11, verse 1. 1 Corinthians 11:1. "Imitate me," Paul said, "as I also imitate Christ." So Paul makes these statements about relationships, and he says, "Imitate me as I imitate Christ." And what I'd like to do for the balance of the sermon is to go through a few examples of how Christ dealt with people with whom he came in contact. And I think we're going to notice that he deals differently with different people for good reason in maintaining relationships. Let's talk about Peter first because he's such a bigger-than-life personality. Let's go to Matthew 14, verse 24. Again, many of you are probably familiar with this example, but my wife keeps telling me, don't assume we all know these stories. You need to turn to the Scripture and let's talk about them. So let's go to Matthew 14 in verse 24, which is the accounting of the story of the disciples on the Sea of Galilee during a storm. And oftentimes the best fishing is in the north of the Sea of Galilee, and storms can come up. And when you see the mountains and the way they're configured there, you can see how winds can come from the Mediterranean over those hills. I say hills. There would be hills to us, but mountains to them. Of maybe 1,500, 2,000 feet, and then the wind sweeps down across the lake and can create these almost instantaneous storms. And oftentimes fishermen can be stranded out there in one of these storms and have to ride it out. So We see here in Matthew 14, beginning in verse 24, "But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary." One of those storms had blown up. "And now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus came to them, walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled. And they said, 'It's a ghost.' They cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them and said, 'Don't worry about it. It is I. Do not be afraid.' And Peter answered him and said, 'Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water.'" What do you know about Peter? Well, Peter is a pretty presumptuous fellow, isn't he? Wouldn't we call him presumptuous? If Peter were in the congregation, where would he be? Probably standing next to the front door when you came in, right? Greeting you. He wasn't a shrinking violet, you know, that you might have to look around the hall and say, "Oh yeah, he's sitting in the back of the room." No. Peter was right out there, wasn't he? Why was it Peter and not one of the other disciples who said, "Well, Christ, if it's you, call me out on the water and I'll come to you, if it's really you"? He was adventurous. He was presumptuous. He was straightforward. He sometimes took liberties where you shouldn't take liberties. He was very outspoken. And Christ acknowledged that he was a leader among men because of his characteristics. And so verse 29, Christ said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. And when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid and began to sink and cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" You know, I've dealt with a lot of members of God's church over the years, other ministers, and a lot of times I have seen a lack of faith. I have experienced it myself. I can only imagine how they would have felt, or I would have felt, if someone had come to me and said, "Dave, you have very little faith. Why did you doubt?" That's a pretty harsh statement, isn't it? To come up to somebody and say, "You have little faith." It was the truth. It was played out right in front of his own eyes. He just experienced it. And Peter took it, didn't he? Peter was the kind of guy you had to pick up a 2x4 and hit him between the eyes to get his attention. He was not very sensitive. Right? Let's look at another example over in Mark, where Christ is dealing with Peter. Or maybe in this case, Peter is dealing with Christ. This is Mark chapter 8, verse 31. Mark 8, verse 31. It says in verse 31 of Mark 8, "And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and eventually be killed, and after 3 days rise again. And he spoke this word openly. Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him." Can you imagine yourself pulling your rabbi, Jesus Christ, aside and rebuke him? Just the thought of that gives me the willies to think about that. Who would be so presumptuous as to correct the teacher? Well, there are some people. It's kind of interesting. Mr. Frank said to me one time, he said, "Dave, you know, things were so much easier when we only had 2 scholars in the church." He says, "Now with the advent of internet, we have 10,000. Here was Peter pulling aside the teacher and saying, you know, you shouldn't be talking this way. In verse 33, and then when he turned around and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter publicly in front of all of his disciples. Get behind me, Satan, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men. Wow. Like I said, I've dealt with all kinds of people, different temperaments in God's church over the years, and I don't think I have ever said to anybody, get behind me, Satan. How do you think Peter felt? Those are rough words for relationship building, aren't they? But Peter bounced right back. Because as we say, his skin was tougher than a rhinoceros. He was just a tough guy. That was his temperament. And Christ knew he had to deal with him in this way in order to get through to Peter. He had to deal with him with a 2x4 and the way he had his relationship developed with Peter. That's just the way he was. Now, think of any of the other disciples. Who would you think is on the opposite end of the pendulum? Maybe John? Let's look at John. How did Christ deal with John? John 19, verse 26. Just a couple of examples here. John 19, verse 26. We're going to see that Christ deals with him in a different way. Normally we say, well, the golden rule is to treat people as you want to be treated. And I will tell you that sometimes that's a recipe for disaster. I dealt with my son the way I wanted to be treated. And that was the absolute worst possible way I could deal with my son. Because I'm a certain temperament, and I found out my son is a different temperament, and he needs to be dealt with differently than I do, or that I should have dealt with him. And I discovered that when I discovered my temperament and his temperament and how different we were. And then it amazed me once I made these discoveries. Wow, how can my son come from this gene pool? And I think sometimes we find that with our children, don't we? That our children are just totally different. You have a little boy or a little girl or two little boys and they're entirely different. Even twins sometimes are entirely different. Well, notice here how Christ deals with John. John chapter 19, verse 26. Let's begin reading in verse 25. And now there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother's sister Mary, and the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. And when Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing by. See, John didn't even write about himself in the first person. He was self-demeaning in that way. And Jesus, when he saw his mother, the disciple whom he loved standing by, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Speaking of John. And then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." And from that hour, that disciple took her to his own home. And the tradition is, of course, that John eventually took her, Christ's mother, with him to Ephesus in Asia Minor. And they both lived out, or the mother, his mother lived out her days until she died in Ephesus, being a dependent, if you will, of John the Baptist. Now, let me ask you, why didn't Christ choose Peter to be the caretaker for his mom after his crucifixion? Well, that's a no-brainer, right? Who do you want taking care of your mom? Presumptuous bull in a china closet? Or somebody who's really going to love your mother and take good care of her and be conscientious and dependable and be tender with her and to help her in times of need? Plus, of course, well, let's go over there. Let's go to John 21. It's back just a couple of pages or ahead if you go that way. John 21, verse 20. In verses 15 through 19, we have this exchange about Peter and Christ talking. And, of course, we know that Peter denied Christ and then Christ asked him to feed his lambs, tend to my sheep, feed my sheep, you know, in answer to this question of, do you love me? And then we get into this interesting part I'd like to focus on in verse 20. Then after this discussion, Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following. That's John, the writer of this gospel, who also had leaned on his breast at the supper and said, Lord, who is the one who betrays you? In other words, there was a very close relationship between Christ and John. They could be close in a little different way than Christ was with Peter. And Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, but Lord, what about John? Because Christ said very plainly in verse 18 that Peter was going to live a life of a vagabond and eventually a martyr. And immediately Peter looks around and he says, well, okay, that's my fate. What's going to happen to John? What about John? What's going to be his fate? And those are those famous words that came from Christ. In verse 22, he said, if I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? Which indicates each and every one of us are called into a set of certain circumstances that, as Paul said, it's unwise to compare ourselves among ourselves. And the circumstances that John had were totally different than those that Peter would have. And John ended up, of course, being the longest living disciple and apostle for obvious reasons. Of course, he authored the book of Revelation and he took care of Christ's mother until her death. He was a caretaker. He had a different temperament, a different personality than did Peter. They were totally different. And Christ treated them differently. Why did Christ treat them differently? Because he understood their temperament, he understood where they were coming from, and he understood what they needed, and he treated them in different ways because he understood that. Okay, I don't want to leave the ladies out. Let's look at Christ's example. How did Christ treat Mary and Martha? Remember Mary and Martha? The sisters of Lazarus? Let's go to Luke 10, verse 38. Luke 10, verse 38. In Luke 10, in verse 38, we read, and now it happened as he went that he entered a certain village, which we know later to be Bethany, and a certain woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary, who also sat at Jesus' feet and heard his word. But Martha was distracted with much serving, and she approached him and said, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Therefore, tell her to help me. Now you might think, well, this is a reasonable request, and I think certainly it would be. But it does point out the difference in these two women. Martha is very task-oriented, right? Focused. I got to prepare the meal. I got to get the dinner on the table, which is a necessary item, you know, when you've got Christ coming for dinner. You want to make sure somebody prepares something, right? So Martha was, you know, it literally says here that she was distracted with much serving. She forgot, in essence, that God on earth was in her living room. And there might be something more important here than chicken. But that's what she was focused on, was putting the bird on the table. And she was even more focused on the fact that Mary wasn't helping. Mary was listening to Christ and what he was saying. And Jesus said to her in verse 41, Martha, Martha, you are worried and troubled about many things. She was a worrywart. She was task-oriented. She was very concerned about accomplishing tasks. This was part of her temperament. And she was much different than her sister, Mary. But one thing is needed, Christ said in verse 42, and Mary has chosen that good part which will not be taken away from her. See, the chicken is going to pass through, but the wisdom and the knowledge and the truth that is going into Mary's head is going to stay there for a lifetime. He was trying to get her to focus on priorities. Now, all of us have been distracted by details and things we, you know, immediate needs rather than important needs, haven't we? That was what happened to Martha. I think Christ treated Martha and Mary a little differently. Let's notice another example. This is over in John 11. John 11 in verse 2, and again, you'll probably recognize John 11, verse 2. You'll notice this is the story of the death of Lazarus. It says in verse 2 of John 11, it was that Mary who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. So she had a pretty close relationship with Christ, didn't she? Therefore, the sisters sent to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. Jesus is sick. We want you to come right away and heal him. And we find out that he was really sick unto death, so he was really sick. And Christ said, well, the sickness is not unto death, and I'll get there when I get there. Now, Christ knew that this would be the miracle that would turn the tide, and that the Pharisees would then say, okay, that's it. We're going to crucify this guy. And this was the miracle that led to his betrayal and crucifixion. You can read that as it unfolds here in the last chapters of the book of John. So this was the one, this miracle that Christ is about to perform. But Christ says, don't worry. And Christ delays his trip to Bethany by 2 days. Kind of a strange reaction, of course, to a request for prayer for the sick. But he eventually goes, and of course you know what happens. He resurrects Lazarus, performs this great miracle. The greatest of all miracles is to raise someone from the dead. Second greatest miracle is to heal one who's been blind from birth, according to the Jews, kind of, you know, evaluating what are the greatest miracles. He does that in John 9, and then in John 10 and 11, he raises Lazarus from the dead. And like I said, this kind of culminates in the eventual trial and crucifixion of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. But the interaction that takes place with the women is very interesting. I don't know if you've noticed it before. Before Christ resurrects Lazarus, notice what happens. Let's drop down to trying to pick this up. Verse 14. Then Jesus said to them very plainly, Lazarus is dead. And I am glad for your sakes that I was not here or not there, that you may believe, because he knew he was about to resurrect him. Nevertheless, let us go to him. And then we drop down to verse 20. Then Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went out to meet him. She's more like Peter. I'm going to go out and meet him. My brother's dead. I want to go tell Christ that if he would have come earlier, he'd be alive. So she goes out there and kind of like Peter reproves Christ. It says, where were you? And she goes, and Martha said to Jesus in verse 21, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And Christ reassures her and says, well, you know, your brother's going to be in the resurrection. And she goes, I know that. I know about the resurrections. That's not very comforting. He's dead. And where's Mary? Well, Mary's in the house. She's not presumptuous the way her sister is. We already know that, right? She's waiting in the house. Martha feels for her sister Mary. And so Martha takes it upon herself to go back to the house after she has this little brief discussion with Christ. And she says to Mary, Christ is here and he wants to talk to you. Which was not the truth. But she wanted to comfort her sister. She knew her sister was more easily bruised, if you will, more emotionally bruised. And so Mary comes out and talks to Christ, and Christ talks to Mary in a little different way because he understands that she's a different temperament. She bruises more easily. She's more tender. She's a little more soft. She's probably more emotional than Martha is. He deals with these women in two different ways. I'll let you read the account, but I think it's pretty interesting to see how Christ dealt. Christ had the knack of knowing people and treating them most effectively. How was he able to do that? Well, you might say, well, he had God's Spirit. Yes, he did. Tells us very clearly. How was he able to do it? He had God's Spirit. We find in Luke chapter 2, verse 52, he grew in favor with God and man. And we know he had God's Spirit from birth. He also had the gift of discernment, which Paul encourages us to pray for. Discern what? Well, discern where people are coming from. Discern how we can deal effectively with different people. Peter acknowledges that we should dwell with them according to knowledge, talking to the men. And that's what we're going to be discovering during the Bible study, is the knowledge that will help us, I believe, understand ourselves better and to be able to deal more effectively with other people. And of course, that's how Christ learned, his experience. I learned a lot about myself and my son in dealing with him back in 1992. A great deal. I learned even more when I discovered some of the things we're going to talk about during the Bible study that will follow. So let's conclude services. Take about a 10-minute break. You can have a coffee maybe, a little bit of a snack, and then in about 10 minutes we'll resume and we'll have the Bible study. And be sure and bring your profiles with you. If you didn't bring